My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Sarah Gruen. Sarah, welcome to KBOO and welcome to Portland.
Thank you.
Sarah Gruen is the author of Ape House, published by Spiegel and Grau, but Sarah is also the author of Water for Elephants, which, alas, I did not read, but you have done something which I thought was impossible. My wife's book club is the most contentious book club I've ever heard of, and nobody agrees on anything, but everybody liked your book.
Wow.
Water for Elephants.
That's great.
Yes. Let me tell people a little bit about you. You're born in Canada, and you have dual citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'm happy to share you with them. Your books deal greatly with animals, and you're a supporter of numerous charitable organizations that support animals and wildlife. That's good. You moved here in 1999 for a tech writing job. I'm a former tech writer. We can commiserate later, maybe. You got laid off 2 years later. Yes, I know about this. Decided to try your hand at writing fiction, a devoted animal lover. Your first novel, Riding Lessons, it was a USA Today bestseller. Second one, Flying Changes, it was about horses. And Water for Elephants allegedly was about elephants.
Elephant.
Yes. And it was a circus, set in the circus, correct?
Yes.
Okay. One of the most beloved and best-selling novels of our time. Did you write that one yourself? Maybe. Until 2007, you and your children, your husband, your various menagerie here, lived in an environmentalist community in northern Illinois. If you want to talk about that, maybe we can talk about that.
Sure.
You now live near where Thomas Wolfe started out, in North Carolina. Well, welcome again.
Thank you.
Again, the title of your book is Ape House, and this is a story of man's inhumanity to simian, I suppose, in a way, and along with man's inhumanity to fellow man. Why don't you set the scene for us? The very opening scene, we have some journalists on their way to interview a scientist named Isabel Duncan. Set up what's going on.
They're actually just returning from it. They're on the way home, and basically, they've been visiting with a family of language competent bonobo apes, and that night, the lab gets bombed. And so what started out as a personal interest story has suddenly become the story of the century, and these reporters will do anything to keep their story.
Now, there's a woman named Kat Douglas, and she, in and of herself, represents everything that's bad about modern journalism. I saw in her tabloids and I saw in her Fox News. She seems to represent all of that. Is that what she's there for?
Well, she does various things, but she's sort of a nasty human being. She has made a name for herself using dubious reporting methods.
Mm. And we never hear of that before. But the book focuses on a few people. One is named John Thigpen. He's a reporter. He has a certain amount of personal integrity. He's writing for the Philadelphia Inquirer when we meet him, as is Kat and their photographer named Osgood. And Isabel Duncan, I guess she's a primatologist. I'm not remembering from the book. But she is the one who cares for, in every sense of the term, the bonobo, what used to be called pygmy chimps. They're not really chimps, but they're closely related. Am I correct?
Well, they're actually their own species.
They
share 98.7% of their DNA with us, as do chimpanzees, but in fact, they're also only related 98.7% with chimpanzees.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at a perfect triangle, we're the three points.
Yeah. Back 40 years ago, when I was studying anthropology, I became interested in primatology, and I know that Pan is the genus for all of the African apes. Gorillas are Pan Pongidae is the whole thing, but also chimps and bonobos, and now they say that orangutan are also part of that. But again, you know, bonobos, nobody really knew much or cared much about them until, I don't know, what, 30 years ago or so?
I had never heard of them 4 years ago. And
is that right?
Yeah, that was one of the reasons that I was so fascinated by the work going on at Great Ape Trust, is that I had never heard of bonobos. They only were given their own species, you know, Pan Paniscus in 1928, I think, and that itself was a zoological scoop because the fellow who actually discovered that it was a separate species had the two skulls sitting out on his desk and made the mistake of telling someone else, who scooped him and wrote it up in an article.
Mm-hmm. The idea that we share so much DNA, clearly, to me, it indicates two things. Number one, that we're very, very, very close, and that observing their behavior, while it's not a complete predictor of human behavior, is necessary in understanding some of the things that we do and why we do some of the things we do. But that last 1.3% of DNA is really, really important, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And that was one of the things I was looking at in the book, is that human society has a lot of the same problems that chimpanzee society has: warfare, violence, usually domestic violence. Chimpanzees practice infanticide on a regular basis. And so people have for many years explained away these behaviors, saying, well, you know, it's hardwired into chimps, therefore it's hardwired into us.
The killer ape theory.
Right. And yeah. So suddenly we have another model. They're equally related to us. They're matriarchal, egalitarian, peaceful. There is no infanticide because bonobos have so much sex that no male bonobo knows which babies are his. I mean, that's one of the theories, but it makes a lot of sense. And so, we're not chimps and we're not bonobos and we're not merely a combination of the two. And, you know, one of the things I was looking at in the book is, can we predict which side is going to pop up at any given moment? And do we have any control over it? And I don't know.
The five bonobos, is it five? I think it's six, maybe. Bonzi, Umbongo, Jelani, Makena, Lola, and Sam.
Mm-hmm.
Is that all of them?
Yes.
They live in this facility, and they're extremely well cared for, because Isabel not only cares for them because of scientific reasons, for whatever her grants are and things like that, what she's studying, but she also loves these creatures, and they love her back. And the thing about this is that we tend to think of humans as the only – first, we thought of them as the only ones with real speech, and that went away a long time ago. Everything from whales to jackdaws have their own way of speaking. But then it became the idea of, do we have real emotions? Do we have thoughts? Can we plan the future? And all of this is getting very blurred now, isn't
it? It's just a constantly changing thing. As soon as the apes get speech, then they change it to, well, we have tools. Well, then the apes use tools. So then it's, oh, no, well, we're the only ones who have empathy. No, then they can prove that apes show empathy. And so it's ongoing. People who want to find a distinction, saying that, well, they're very, very special top creatures, we'll find a distinction, and we are humans, and they're not human, and they know it, and we know it, and I don't think that really is important. They're also not the ones wrecking the world.
Well, there's not enough of them. Heaven knows what would happen if there were 6 billion bonobos. I don't know, but this is the kind of thing that drives the creationists crazy, is the idea that not only do chimps, gorillas, orangutans and bonobos have the capacity for compassion, have loved their children, have the capacity to do war and the capacity to create peace, but they can also transmit culture. And we know that because of American Sign Language. Yes?
Well, and yeah, I mean, we know that for a variety of reasons, but the bonobos that I worked with and visited at the Great Ape Trust use a series of lexigrams, not American Sign Language. But it's a board that contains 384 symbols that represent words, and they push a button on the computer and a synthesized human voice says the word. And they do teach their children this, and the trust is a very unique setting. It's a bi-species, bi-cultural environment, and so yes, the apes there really have taken on some human attributes, and they now have a third generation. They have a new baby there, and it's going to be very interesting to see how he acquires language.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the book, you indicate that they are able to teach their young. They sign to their young, and the young learn to sign back. And in fact, my cousin who adopted a baby from China taught her some words in American Sign Language, word for more, the word for mama, the word things like that. And this child actually learned that way before she learned speech, because the neural pathways are developed earlier than the speech pathways are.
Yeah, that's one of the things people do with babies. And my stepdaughter's son knew how to ask for food way before he could speak, and he was using signs.
Yeah, Isabel. Let me back up a little bit. Being a person like you who loves animals and is involved in, organizations that protect animals from harm, things. Am I correct in that?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I liked about this book is you are willing to take on pretty much anybody that's involved in this whole process, including the protesters, who may or may not have the best interests of the animals at heart, as much as a political idea, which seems to fill their entire universe. You said that the place gets blown up. Describe what happens.
Well, the rest of the people have left the building. So Isabel is there alone with the bonobos. Her intern, Celia, has gone for a coffee run. The important factor there is that she's borrowed Isabel's car, and so that it looks like the parking lot is empty. And at that point, a bomb is detonated and the lab blows up. And Isabel is grievously injured, and the apes escape.
Yeah, hang out in the trees, from which they have to be removed by being shot with tranquilizer darts. That really annoyed me.
Yeah, and would be pretty traumatic for the apes.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is that the people who blew the facility up probably weren't thinking much about the apes at all, were they? Because they had no idea of knowing whether those apes would be injured or not.
Well, that's kind of a plot spoiler. Cause I...
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, everybody forget what I just said. I was trying to, you know, I was doing this on a more abstract level. I mean, you know, this occurs to me that that's...
Well, the people who blew up the lab absolutely did not have their best interests in heart.
Yeah, okay. I apologize for that. There were a bunch of other people involved here. Among the protesters is a kid named Nathan and a guy named Larry Harry Gary. Why is his name Larry Harry Gary?
His name is Larry Harry Gary because Isabel knows that the apes, nothing bad is happening to the apes with her. She's just learning... teaching them, you know, learning about language cognition and acquisition. And so she just feels that these people have no idea what's going on, and so she just pays them no attention. So at some point they've heard something that rhymes with Larry, Harry, or Gary, and so that's just the name that they've given him.
Okay, I think that's pretty funny because that's the way people's minds really operate. So, John Thigpen, let's get him back to him. He has a wife named Amanda, and Amanda has a writing career, which we were talking about before I started recording, seriously parallels mine in a lot of ways, and what made me laugh because the same indignities that occurred to me also were foisted upon her, which leads me to believe that maybe it's more common than I thought it was.
Oh, it's very common. I took all of the horror stories from all of my writer friends and threw them all in a pot, stirred it around, and pulled out Amanda.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us about her writing career. What has she written, and what happens to her eventually?
Well, she has written mostly. She's written for an online sportswear catalog, so she's writing about mucklucks and Teflon and all the thing, you know.
Yeah. Why does Jay Peterman pop into my head?
Right, exactly. The urban sombrero.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
yeah. So that's what she was writing until she wrote a novel, and it was literary fiction, and so... It did all right. It wasn't a terribly great advance, and it didn't blow off the charts. And then the economy downturn hit, and she, her entire publishing company got swept away, and her agent was so disenchanted by the whole business that she started a natural fiber yarn boutique.
Well, the other thing that happens is that she decides she's going to be a screenwriter or someone who writes television scripts and agitates to move to Los Angeles, which is, of course, the navel of that universe. And you take on the TV industry, and I know the great line from Annie Hall where Woody Allen's friend moves out to Los Angeles, and they're driving around Los Angeles, and he says, "Look, no garbage in the streets." And Woody says, "Yeah, they collect it all and turn it into television scripts." Let me remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Sarah Gruen. Her last name is spelled G-R-U-E-N. The title of her book is Ape House, and it's published by Spiegel & Grau. Poor Amanda. I mean, it's not enough that John Thigpen has he worries about the bonobos. He worries about Isabel Duncan. He worries about what's going on in his own life because he gets fired from the Philadelphia Inquirer, and now he has to worry that his wife is going nuts on him. You're really twisting this poor guy's life out of shape.
Yeah, he's not a happy guy at the beginning, most of the way through. And you know, Amanda, they're both writers. Pardon me, they're both writers who suffer indignities in their own craft and trade, and John, of course, ends up going from the Philadelphia Inquirer to a glossier version of the National Inquirer, only his editor has said to include slightly fewer alien babies.
Mm-hmm.
And Amanda goes for the screenwriting job, hoping that it will lead her to better things, and suffers more indignities of a different manner, like including commercials that have to be built into the script, like holding mayonnaise jars up to your face for a certain number of seconds each time, or having Macy's bags parade through each episode. And you know, it's at one point they're supposed to be ripping off Sex and the City. And then some kind of focus group decides that those actors are too old, and so they swap out all the actors, and instead they're actually ripping off Gossip Girl or the equivalent.
Mm-hmm. Why let a good idea go to waste, eh?
Right.
Yeah, that's like the business where they say never reinvent the wheel. You know,
that's
what TV is all about these days. How many CSI versions are there? I watch all of them, by the way. The other thing that I do is to me, the greatest invention of the first decade of the 21st century is a digital video recorder where I can zip through the ads. And that's why they have to do these product placements in the stupid shows.
That is correct. That's why you're seeing the mayonnaise jars.
Okay, well, you know, I can deal with that as long as the plot keeps rolling while they're holding the vitamin water up to their ear.
That's right.
Yeah. Ken Falks, tell us about Ken Falks.
Well, he used to be a legitimate media guy, and then he turned to the greener pastures of porn.
Yes. The biggest business in America.
I think
that, you know, I think if it were a legitimate business, it'd be the third or fourth largest industry in the country. Is that?
I'm surprised it's not doesn't rank higher than that.
Maybe one or two higher than that. Like the defense industry, for example. But yeah. Do you want to tell us when the bonobos escape the facility after the explosion? They go into the trees and they are taken captive, allegedly for their own good, and you know it's by a county animal shelter or something like that, right?
Well, once they're rescued from the trees, because they are out there in sleet and hail and they're delicate animals, they are shot out of the trees and they need to be taken somewhere because their home has been bombed. And so they go to animal control, and of course animal control is not equipped to deal with apes, and they disappear for several months after that. John Thigpen is hot on the trail and goes and discovers that they've been just taken away in the night in a truck with a covered license plate.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you want to tell us where they wind up?
Oh, yeah, sure. They reappear later in their own reality television show.
Titled?
Ape House.
Oh, wow, it's funny, the title of your book. Did you work that out cleverly, or is it just a coincidence that it's Ape House?
Actually, I think that it came to me at the same moment as the book. It's the only good title I've ever come up with in my life. I've never come
Water
up
Water for Elephants? That's
no, but somebody
title.
Else titled that.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, I didn't mean to bring up a sore topic.
Oh, no, I'm very bad at titles, usually.
Okay.
So I like this one. I think this was good.
Well, you know, Beethoven didn't call it the Ember Concerto. What can I tell you? Ape House is a simian version of Big Brother or one of those idiot shows where it's not enough to intrude on people's personal lives, even people who have volunteered for this thing, but artificial conflict has to be created as well. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Ken Falks is trying very hard to create something like Big Brother or even, dare I say, Jersey Shore. Where
talk about simian behavior,
right? Yeah, well, except that simians would be much more dignified. Because bonobos, culturally, they have a lot of sex. That's the way one of the ways they communicate and relieve tension and reaffirm friendship. It doesn't mean anything else other than a handshake to them. But because of this, Ken Falks is truly hoping that he will catch the prurient interest of the TV viewing audience, and of course he does. But the apes refuse to get into fights or form alliances or do any of the other things that happen that really are the gravy of reality TV. And so he keeps trying to throw things into the mix that will encourage them to misbehave and ratchet things up a notch.
Okay, so far you've taken on the media, you've taken on TV. You've taken on extreme animal rights protesters.
Oh, extreme all sorts of protesters.
Extreme, yes, all sorts of protesters, that's right. And now, of course, you've taken on... is there any who you haven't taken on in this book, come to think of it? I mean, was this a general disdainment for the culture as it exists?
That particular slice of culture, yeah. I mean, it was this kind of celebrity culture, and I don't even want to call them celebrities. I think I'll call them celebutants, because some of them, I have no idea why they're famous, other than
the Kardashian sisters.
They leaked a sex tape, and suddenly they're famous.
That's what it was?
I think.
I'm dumbstruck.
I know, me too. I started writing a book, and it just sort of came out.
Whew. Okay, so I'm thinking again about the bonobos. The thing that you mentioned was that it's like a handshake to them, that they have frequent sex, pansexual, the hookups are not necessary, between the same sex or different sexes.
Every variety, every type of sexual contact you can imagine the bonobos have.
That's right. Everything that we humans think we're so cool to have invented, the bonobos have been doing for a longer time.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And every hour and a half.
Every hour and a half. But you don't know that it's really just like a handshake to them. It might be deeply meaningful. I mean,
oh, it is deeply meaningful. It just doesn't mean that, I'm choosing you as a mate.
Uh-huh.
It just means, oh, you're my best friend. Or, oh, look, let's go share some food.
This is another reason to horrify the extremely religious or the social conservatives, because sex is used as a social lubricant. Sex is used as a way to make peace.
Mm-hmm.
And their morality, and I will use that word, their morality says, we do this to make each other feel good and make ourselves feel good and thereby diffuse any bad situations and for the social cohesion of the group. This is wonderful.
If you look at the pictures of bonobos while they're having sex, much of the time they do it face-to-face, and it's very clear from their faces that they're enjoying it.
Good. The other thing that they do, given their head, is start pigging out on junk food. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, I was having another little poke. But there's people... It's been proven that people do eat much more junk food immediately after viewing junk food commercials full of, glistening burgers and slabs of cheese and all this stuff. And the bonobos, when they're given their reality TV show, are put in an empty house with a computer and unlimited credit. And so they're watching one of the first things they order is a TV. And so they're watching all these junk food commercials and start ordering pizzas and cheeseburgers and all the things that really are not good for them.
Mm-hmm. And that just gives Isabel and John Thigpen even, they say, oh my God, they're killing these poor apes with bad food and they're not taking care of them. And one of the bonobos is pregnant.
Yes.
And about to deliver a baby. And they don't even know if she's being well taken care of because there's not a veterinarian on staff that anybody cares about.
Nobody really knows if the people who own her,
mm-hmm.
Even know that she's pregnant, because they are so secretive and they're not communicating and they're not granting interviews. And in fact, nobody exactly knows where they're stationed.
This just popped into my head. If they don't like somebody, the bonobos don't like somebody, one of the bad things they would call them is a bad, dirty toilet.
Yes.
I really love that.
Thank you. Dirty, bad toilet. That's a direct quote from Coco the Gorilla.
Coco the Gorilla. That's right. The first of the anthropoid apes to be taught American Sign Language.
Yeah, one of the first wave. She was, she and, of course, Washo and Bowie.
Washo, I've been reading Diane Fossey and Jane Goodall and Shirley Strum, who work with baboons, and for 40 years now. And I'm constantly struck with the idea that if we adopted ape morality, we'd probably be a lot better off.
It depends on the ape. There are some aspects of chimpanzees that I really would like us to not emulate any more than we already do.
Yeah, well, we do that anyway.
Yeah.
We don't need much prompting to do that.
Yeah. I do think that we could learn a lot from bonobos. And, one of the things, I don't know if you've noticed, picked up on it, but the guns and waffles sign in the book, when
yes.
John and Amanda are driving to her cousin's wedding, they pass a sign. And this was actually a sign that I passed near where I live, offering guns and waffles. I thought, that's sort of perfect. It's, the chimps and the bonobo side of us.
Well, you do live in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Enough said about that. I do. There was on the Lower East Side of New York, East Village, there was a sign that said, all night cappuccino and tattoos. I think the place is still there. It's on St. Mark's Place.
I guess it's better than All Night Tequila and Tattoos.
Maybe business
would be better for
I'm sure
tequila.
You can get tequila there as well, but I don't know that for a fact. I really enjoy this book. It works itself out. Not only is it a great satire on pretty much everything that annoys us in the world today. You've done a very good job of spreading your annoyance around. But it also has a mystery quality to it as well, because Isabel and John and Isabel's intern Celia and a couple of her buddies are hot on the trail of where to find the bonobos, because nobody knows where they are for a very, very long time. So it's got a lot going for it. And then it does have a nice happy ending. You've kind of wrapped up everything in a little bow at the end. Did you do that for your own sake or,
Yeah, kind of. I really personally don't like spending money on a book and then coming away from it wanting to kill myself. So,
how about somebody else? You should always direct rage outward.
Right. Well, no. Yeah. So I just try to afford my readers the same kind of courtesy.
What are you working on now?
Nothing until I get off the road.
Is that right?
Yeah. I can't possibly write while I'm touring. It's just there's not enough kind of solid time, because it takes me an hour and a half to get just really started when I'm writing, and then I have to not be interrupted. So if I'm bopping around and getting on planes and doing things.
When I met you, you did have that 1,000-yard stare.
I'm halfway through.
Okay, halfway through? Well,
I think a little bit more then, yeah. The hump day was yesterday or day before?
I hope we've been gentle with you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, thanks.
Okay, so good. But you do have ideas churning around your head, I'm sure.
I have an idea. I just, my writing process is so very organic that if I say anything about the book right now, that when it comes out, it will no longer be in it.
Absolutely. So. I understand that perfectly. It's really been delightful speaking with you. Again, much praise for Water for Elephants. And I recommend that this book is funny and it's touching, and I really got a kick out of it. It's called Ape House. Again, Sarah Gruen, last name spelled G-R-U-E-N, published by Spiegel & Grau. I certainly hope you'll come back.
Oh, of course. Thank you.